Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it is Vodka O'Clock once again, and I'm Amber Love of AmberUnmasked.com. Steve's drink of choice is actually not vodka, apple pie moonshine, and it's delicious. It comes in a mason jar, and I feel like a complete hick drinking it. So, joining me today is Nick DeDwall. He is the creator of Torchbearer, and so we are finally connecting here on Skype. He's also going to talk about a new option that he's involved with on Comixology, and there might be some spoilers if you haven't read Torchbearer issue 1 completely, or if you haven't made it to into issue 2. We will try not to have a huge spoiler, but you know, just letting you know that's a possibility. So Nick, welcome finally to Vodka O'Clock.
Oh, thank you, Amber. It's great to be here.
So, I was trying to get your elevator pitch from you. So let's revisit that.
That's fine. It's the same pitch that I discovered at New York Comic Con. It's spy-fi. It's corporate espionage meets science fiction. And what would you do when corporations start buying up planets, star systems, and entire galaxies? And our argument is that you'll join the Torchbearers, who is the name of the rebel group that will come out in issue 3. It's not a big spoiler, but it's just from the terms of the story, we're keeping it quiet until issue 3. So, yeah.
Okay. I think corporate espionage is a lot of fun to tackle. It's because the government's involved at the same time, it's a little Jason Bourne-ish, somewhat, you know, like Leverage. Definitely a Blade Runner feel to this book.
Thank you. I mean, that's a great compliment, really.
When I was reading it and I was looking at Dennis's artwork, I was just like, okay, wow. So I'm like, this is bringing me back to sitting and watching Blade Runner. So you came up with this amazing artistic team of Dennis Claro doing the artwork and Kevin Lintz, who, by the way, also created Team Slug for you people that like all ages comics. I really highly recommend Team Slug. And what was your editor's name again?
Miss Anoni.
So, you guys, did you know each other before?
I knew Miss Anoni from back in high school. And she's great at what she does, which is keep me sane and edit my stuff. I met Kevin through Comics Experience, and I met Dennis through Twitter.
That's great. Yeah. So, was it a general Twitter call out that you did, like, hey, I've got a first issue done, and I'm looking for an artist, or was it something like you specifically said, hey, Dennis Claro, I love your portfolio, what have you got going on?
Neither. I basically said, hey, are you interested in this kind of project? Then he messaged me in private, and then we coordinated over when to meet and what to discuss. He saw that I was serious, and we met in a Starbucks on 34th Street here in New York City, and we discussed everything. We discussed the small story bible that I had put, the overall arc for the story, and I had issue 1 written completely then. And he liked it, he had great ideas, and he came on board. From then on, before, I had Kevin Lintz working with me on the 5 pages for Comics Experience, so I already knew him as a letterer, and that's how the team came together. And we've been pulling hijinks ever since.
Yeah, I love the lettering. There's parts where it's like a hologram or one of the language coming through the technology interface, and it's got these half oval, almost Nike swish looking things in red around it to match the color, and I loved it.
Yeah, so you're talking about issue 2.
Okay.
Right, issue 2 is a different letterer.
Oh, okay.
His name is Dave Lamp here, and he's worked with the Fantastic Four and Young Avengers, and he's a professional.
Really fantastic job.
Yeah. He actually is a contact I met through somebody I met at New York Comic Con. His name was Troy Petteri, and he was actually on board to letter Torchbearer issue 2. And he couldn't at the last moment, and he recommended his mentor, who was Dave.
It was seamless. Great job from issue 1 to 2.
I wish I could say the credit is mine, but that's Dave.
And that's something that creative teams, when they change in the big houses, mm-hmm. that a lot of people get really upset about. I've been reading Birds of Prey since the new relaunch thing, yeah. New 52, and they've gone through, I think, 4 artist teams. And they're similar enough. Like, you can tell that something's a bit different.
Right.
But first it took a while for Jesus Saez to get get the feel of the characters, because they were all like new reimagined versions of the characters and some new characters altogether. And so just as he sort of was there and grounded, then they changed it up, and they've gone through so many teams on the art side. But it's a very traditional superhero style, and most people wouldn't understand what that is.
Right.
The DC style. Like, if you pick up a Green Lantern comic, you know what I'm talking about. So when you've had to change anything artistically, you either want it to be a big enough difference for a reason, or you want the reader to not lose their immersion. That was something that I did find a problem reading Sandman, because I read Neil Gaiman's Sandman
right.
trade. I didn't read it back in the day of issues for that. So trying to read that through trade, there were so many artistic changes that it was jarring because of the speed that I was going through those trade paperbacks.
I in a way, I agree. I myself read Neil Gaiman's stuff when it was in a trade, not as a single issue. I kind of got it, though. The one I really didn't get, although I logically get why the decision was made, but I didn't particularly like the style, is with Delirium. Mm-hmm. It's Delirium, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's just crazy stuff.
Very crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at least they kept continuity in the art.
Yes.
For particular arcs. So that always makes the best sense possible. If you're going to ever consider changing your art team, try to at least get the, you know, get an end point to make that change. Because otherwise, it really can be a little awkward. But let's talk about, because I was talking about Blade Runner, and today, that we're recording this, not the day that it goes out, but the day that we're recording this was our president's inauguration.
Yes.
So obviously, like, government news and debt ceilings and unemployment and health care and crises are always, like, big, huge headlines for us here. So what headlines really played with you? Anything? Or was this sort of, like, you were just really influenced by, like, older cyberpunk or something?
Without revealing too much, because there's actually so this is going to last for 50 issues, Torchbearer, and I don't really want to reveal the true source of it until,
okay.
like,
Fine.
A couple of years down the line. But I will say that in part I was actually inspired by the KGB, in particular their spy operations, because, like, they are some crazy people at the KGB, especially back in the day, in the 60s.
Yeah.
There's this book called The Sword and the Shield that basically is a story-form version of a KGB archive that was smuggled out from that had detailed history that even most of the KGB people didn't know from when they were founded, the precursor in the 20s till now. And quite frankly, I have to thank the Tea Party also.
Okay.
Because of this obsession with objectivism and Ayn Rand, that in a way, this is me telling you, well, this is what could happen when corporations start getting power. And this is what you want, right? You want corporations to rule everything and to not have any checks and balances? Okay.
Right. Like,
you go.
RoboCop is probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
For that. And it's, you know, and we've sort of been seeing it in the scientific community a bit. I mean, definitely healthcare, because private corporations run our healthcare.
Yeah.
And
only in America, though.
Yeah, I know. And when I was talking to Mike Perkins about we did a science episode, and it was a lot of fun. We were talking about how our space program is basically privatized. I mean, you can't depend on NASA anymore because they've lost so many funds.
Yeah, that's true.
Now we have Virgin and Red Bull.
You know, don't forget SpaceX.
Private investors. It's all, you know, and I could just imagine shuttles looking like NASCAR sponsorships.
They did already.
Yeah, they
had Pizza Hut in the 90s, right, with the Russian mirror.
It was something, and it just seems so bizarre. Like there's going to be, you know, like when are we just going to have because we can easily see things through the satellites and through the telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
We get with the internet, it's amazing and phenomenal. You know, I just expect to see the rover putting up billboards, like you said. You know, put up a Pepsi billboard.
You know, NASA might be listening in. They might take advice from that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
That's how they would pay for the next mission, I'm sure.
And, you know, and you really can't blame it. I mean, even our television viewing has changed where, because people can watch without commercials in certain ways, like Netflix and stuff. They just have product placement. And it's sometimes the shows are really bad about how obvious they are. Like, it's not just somebody reaching into a fridge and taking out a Budweiser anymore. Now it's actually talking about the car that they're driving in and the assisted parallel parking technique mechanism.
Just or like, how Subway is a great sandwich.
Yes. Yeah. And they just throw that in there. So I don't know. I don't know about corporations just running everything like they do. So you have Prometheus Inc., which is massive conglomeration. And Prometheus from mythology is, of course, who stole the fire from the gods.
Mm-hmm.
So are you using the metaphor in the way that the fire is power, or are you using metaphor with the particular technology that you have? Because part of it, and this is where I didn't want to get too spoilery, but I think it's just important to sort of discuss what people can expect in the story,
right,
is you've got this really intriguing transportation in the story.
Right.
And I don't want to assume it's a hologram, so you can explain better what that is. Is it the technology that's being stolen, or was it just power?
Which issue are we talking about, one or two?
Just the art.
Okay. Traditionally, Prometheus has been seen as a giver of knowledge to humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that you can also include technology. That's why, for example, Frankenstein is called also the modern Prometheus.
Right.
So it's both. It's both knowledge and technology.
Okay.
And that what I'm doing in a way is turning the Prometheus myth on its head by using the name Prometheus as everything against the Promethean myth. They're hoarding up technology, right? Because they are this big conglomeration.
Right. And and this is something, again, that we do see in our current lives with our technology and our relationships with these corporations, when things like Instagram and Facebook and, you know, Twitter and Google, they want to take your private information and do whatever they want with it, and you want to use their service, so you just click the OK button.
Yep, and actually goes worse than that, Amber. Do you know of a guy named Aaron Schwartz?
Yes, I just heard the very sad story about Aaron Schwartz.
Do you want to talk about it, or?
Yeah, we can absolutely talk about it.
For those of you who don't know, Aaron Schwartz was this brilliant engineer and software developer.
He was one of the co-founders of Reddit, and he created one of the first RSS protocols, RSS 1.0, and he was involved in the startup scene in the early 2000s, and in the last, I think, year and a half to 2 years, he got in trouble with the U.S. government because he downloaded, I think it was over 250,000 technical papers in this database called JSTOR, and just released them out there in the internet. Now, I'm not a big fan of copyright theft. There's some blog posts in my website about it when I first encountered with Torchbearer that somebody stole the whole issue. Like 24 hours after it was released in New York Comic Con, somebody put it on the internet as a torrent.
As torrent? Right. Yeah. Yeah, that figures.
Right, but...
I've seen free comics torrented, so it's... Mm. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. But I've done research. The people who write research usually are using government grants, so technically the taxpayer owns that research. And they're not getting paid for what they've published. It's actually done and edited by the same researchers. So the people who actually hold the data are now private companies since the early 70s. And they charge you for access to information that you should have. It's plain and simple. And because he did it in a technical way, he got charged with 10 felonies. He got more. He was facing more time than a rapist. And he couldn't take it anymore. And he killed himself in Crown Heights here in Brooklyn.
Yeah, he was very young. He was 26 years old.
Yep.
And these were papers that were on MIT servers, correct?
They were accessible through MIT servers. They could have been just as accessible with Columbia or NYU or any university because universities pay a fee to have access to this database.
Right. So, I mean, we can openly and respectfully debate that he still hacked his way into and
agreed.
He published information that he didn't have the right to publish.
Agreed.
Yeah. But, yeah, absolutely a very, very – they were coming down on him super, super hard. He was being treated like a terrorist.
Even worse.
And as you said, he couldn't take it anymore, and people are basically surmising that that was why he decided to end his life on his terms rather than rot in jail.
Yep.
I'm really glad that you brought this up because when I read the headlines every day and I think about how our fiction is impacted, especially science fiction, because I think it was just the anniversary of George Orwell's death.
Yeah.
The things that people thought were just fantastical and hopeful, like Jules Verne. I mean, they were, you know, hoping for these flying machines and hoping for technology, and they would write these amazing stories. And we finally get to see these things happen, and it's burning us at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Certainly George Orwell and Ray Bradbury with Fahrenheit 451. I'm afraid we've reached that point that we're just burning books soon.
Well, that does happen in certain towns.
Oh, no, don't remind me.
One of the questions that I have drafted up for you is, we also just literally, it's been, I think, 2 months since the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, and literally just like over the weekend, like there were gun shootings in different convention centers and just things that you just can't even imagine. That why are people doing this to each other? Turn it on yourself. I mean, that's my sort of own advice. If you're that miserable, just turn it on yourself. But the entertainment industry is being so badly portrayed that when people like Biden and these other like community uprisings against video games, burning video games, one of the towns, gathered up their, you know, asking people to drop off their video games into a dumpster. All because of these shootings.
Right.
And like you said, they're treating this worse than the attacks themselves. Like bad fiction. Bad fiction. What are you doing?
Right.
And, you know, so here you are as a writer, and you're trying to create something mildly controversial, if it, you know, if somebody wanted to look at it that way.
Right, sure.
You know, and if this were a particular time and in a particular town, you know, somebody would say to you, you're a bad influence, Nick. You need to stop what you're doing. I mean, what's your response to this?
How honest can I be?
You can be as honest as you want.
So I just saw a fantastic movie called Argo.
Okay, I haven't seen it yet. I tried. They were sold out. You know, kudos for doing well.
Yes, but they have this wonderful line whenever somebody questioned them, at least some of the characters there. And they go, Argo, fuck yourselves. That would have been my initial reaction. I would have, of course, not said that. Because I would think the people who are questioning me are suffering in some way in their minds. And I would just kindly remind them that, one, this is fiction. I mean, you want worse things? Go read the news. Anything I can write pales in comparison to the real world out there. And that influences us more than anything I may write. And second, you're responsible. You can't just blame some outside force like a video game or a novel or a comic book for anything you do. Yes, you could argue there is a culture of violence in the United States, in part encouraged by the entertainment industry, because it sells, things sell, violence sells, but it only sells because we choose to buy it.
Right, vote with your dollars, and also parent your kids.
Yes. I mean, we really, as a society, we need to embrace what used to be American, which was take responsibility for our own actions. Seriously. That would be my polite answer.
No, I think that's a fabulous answer. So you've sort of, well, I don't want to say you've invented the technology that appears in Torchbearer, because for all I know, you've done like so much extensive research that people are already working on this, and I don't know. So you've got this interesting transportation system for this character, Coyote.
Yeah. Okay.
Describe what this is so that I'm not, like, misunderstanding it.
No, it's a hologram. You're right.
It's a hologram.
But it's a physical one.
Okay. Because he sort of, like, shrinks down into this pellet.
Right.
And the pellet can be, you know, carried in a you know, somebody's pocket and then dropped in the appropriate room
right, to
get through security systems. And but it also looked like he was able to enter through closed systems, like through closed doorways.
Right.
So how do you address that sort of ghost type situation where, okay, he can phase through something, but at the same time he can also grab things and manipulate things physically?
Well, he didn't phase through it.
Okay.
He just hacked into it.
Okay.
Right. But yeah, the idea is it's a tangible hologram. That's why he's able to break that table. And there's details here and there that I think maybe I need to make sure they're clearer on the next issue. But I digress. Yeah, it's a tangible hologram, and he hacked his way through.
Okay. That's great. Thanks for explaining that. You also have drones at the part of the story where I left off.
Right.
And just days ago, headlines were talking about how the United States has approved the use of drones for civilian surveillance, domestic on our soil surveillance. We are no longer talking about attack drones over in Afghanistan. We are talking about drones fluttering about to watch us.
Right.
And you had it already in the book. So using drones, like, what is, you know, is there a line where we're sort of paying, you know, sacrificing our freedom for our safety?
Oh, I think we paid that price some time ago. This is just the next evolution of it. We, the moment we decided that we felt okay with something like the Patriot Act,
mm-hmm.
is the moment we said, you know what, I want to feel safe, forget my freedom. And this is just a natural extension.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that's what I took by writing it. And knowing the fact that drones are cheap, they're incredibly cheap to build. And they can last for days on end, hovering over an area. It makes more sense than having policemen.
I'm very interested in some of the technology because they've, you know, you think about something maybe the size of a football fluttering through the air. But I love when I see the ones that are like bug shaped and they're meant to actually pass themselves off as like, you know, a hummingbird size or a bug size, and that's really going on.
I'm getting one in September.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a company that did an Indiegogo campaign. They had actually gotten a grant from the U.S. Air Force to develop these drones. And they said, you know, we don't want to wait 10 years till this goes down the line, down the pipeline to the consumer. So we're doing an Indiegogo campaign, and if we can raise $1 million, you get a drone.
And
it was for $150, the initial drone that you built yourself. And then the more the reward that you chose, you could get a camera with Wi-Fi or a high-def camera with Wi-Fi. Now, this doesn't last hours on end. I think the most it can last is 90 minutes. But the technology's there. Making batteries that last indefinitely exists. It's not available for everyone, but it exists.
Right.
Did I just scare you, Amber?
No! It's just such an ethical question. I love discussing this.
Well, the question becomes, do you have a right to take them down?
Well, yeah, I mean, if I were, for example, to find out that somebody's little drone hummingbird was peeping through my window, you're damn straight I'd take it down.
Ah, but here's the problem. There's already precedent by the U.S. government that you cannot remove surveillance equipment from your own private property. There was a guy who they attached a GPS module in his car. He was suspected to be a terrorist because part of his family were known to be terrorists. He is a student here in the U.S., he never had any affiliate. He separated himself from that side of the family. But they suspected him. They attached the GPS. He found it, a GPS module. He found it, posted it online. The FBI said, you shouldn't have done that. They sued him. He had to return it. And
oh, yeah, but I don't mean the government. I don't mean the government taking an interest in me as the terrorist.
Oh.
I mean, you know, Joe Schmo creepy guy.
Ah, right, those.
I mean,
yeah. Dumb.
If there's going to be a, you know, a butt shot of me on the internet, I'm going to be the one to put it there. And there's plenty. There's plenty of them. It's not like I oppose certain things. I just want to be the one that controls where my image is. I mean, it's sort of something that we go through with celebrities and celebrity worship all the time.
Yeah.
That they have zero, absolutely zero privacy whatsoever. I mean, they move out of the country in order to just have children and raise a family because you can't do it here.
Yeah.
Talking about the surveillance and the drones and stuff, I also saw that there was, I believe it's a British company, but now I'm not sure. Some guy with the know-how to do this has invented a sweatshirt that blocks heat signatures.
Yeah.
So, you know, for all I know and for all you know, something like that might actually become illegal because here, and I know it's state by state, but if, for example, you run through a toll bridge and you didn't have your easy pass or you didn't pay,
right,
they will take a picture of your license plate. And so there are these things that allegedly disrupt what the license plate can read.
Right.
So basically anything that disrupts the government from doing its job and fining you for something or bringing you up on some kind of charge, you're not allowed to have that in your car. Like, you're not allowed to have your license plate blocked by something that an officer can't read. So when I read this article about these cloaking sweatshirts and that they're working on things like backpacks and whatnot for your cell phones and everything as well, I was thinking, but this is all well and good until somebody says it's illegal to have it.
Right.
So, I mean, as soon as the technology is there, somebody is also out there with the counter technology.
That's the nature of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to escalate because somebody builds the way to... they build a way to peer through it. Somebody builds a better way to hide themselves through it. It's just going to keep going until everyone's invisible and nobody knows where the hell everyone is. Or,
yeah,
you know, we'll just stay in the internet. Whichever.
Yeah, I mean, but it's very scary to think that you need a firewall for your own personal physical being.
You know, I never thought of that. Just calling it that, a firewall.
Yeah.
I may steal that.
You may. And you will sign my books when I see you.
Sounds good.
Let's talk about, you know, now that I just said sign my books and they're digital, you've also been involved with a new program through Comixology called Comixology Submit.
Yes.
So please tell the audience what that is.
That is Comixology's new endeavor to bring indie and creator-owned books to their marketplace. And
it's been very hard for some people to do, so that's appreciated.
Say that again?
It's been very hard for some people to do, for smaller press to do.
Yes.
So it's definitely appreciated. It was wanted, and they replied and responded with this submit. And Torchbearer is one of the first books.
Yes, it is. What I can say is that you need to pay attention and schmooze when you go to Comic Cons, because that's how you meet people, and that's how I met certain people who allowed me this opportunity. There's not much I can say beyond that, other than the process is fairly straightforward. I think we're right now, me and the first people who came out were part of a beta. And I think it's going to run for several months. I'm not sure how long before it's the floodgates are open and everyone can submit through it.
Okay. Well, that's fair. It's fair to have to test the waters.
Right.
It
pays to be charming too. You should tell your audience that.
Of course,
charming,
yeah.
and polite.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Comixology has sort of become known as the diamond monopoly comics, and so people were looking for alternate ways to get their digital books out there.
Yes.
Some people were creating, spending their time and their energy creating their own digital apps just to get their comics out there. And then there's other services, I think, like Drive-Thru Comics, that are easier.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things where when you have the brand recognition, it's and you're rejected, it's the same as the way, I mean, people have been complaining about Diamond's criteria for years. I mean, that book used to be, the Diamond catalog used to be like twice the size of what it is now. So I know that Comixology is they're taking their own success and having to deal with the pitfalls of success at this point.
Yes.
And when I saw the announcement that came out, because it's like two of the first books are people from Comics Experience.
Right.
So I was just like so excited because I was like, oh, Comixology is never going to, you know, print, you know, not even that they have to print, but they're never going to even make accessible something that might do 10,000 copies. But being not, I mean, other than being nice, is there, what's the process? Just you have to have your book completed? Do you have to have a certain number of issues?
Oh, no. No. At this stage, since we were in the beta, the criteria was more, I hate to say it, but it's who you know.
Okay.
And both Janine, who did Quandary, you know, fantastic book, and myself, we talked to some people at Comixology, and I gave them my book, my Torchbearer copy from New York Comic Con, and that's, I signed it, and you know, we talked, and in a way, I have somewhat of an advantage because I'm technical, and I can talk technical with these people, and
okay,
that allowed me in the door, in a way.
Okay. And it's interesting that Quandary is the other book because it's another very Orwellian
right.
book.
I mean, mind you, this is all because it's beta. When it's the process is going to be very open to everyone, and I'm not part of the decision process. I don't know what it's going to be, but I can guarantee you that it'll be far easier to get your books into Comixology than into Diamond.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so.
I hope so too.
And I'm just, and it's one of those things where one of the reasons that I was so happy that it was these particular books is because I saw criticism, and I don't even remember who on my feed said it, that it was that they were saying, you know, geez, the Comixology homepage, the interface alone just screams superhero book.
Right.
That it's, you know, big bubbly things and, you know, very specific color palette, that you don't go there expecting anything else from except something mainstream. And in fact, and today, because I reviewed two books recently, and both of them were autobiography type books. They weren't even just slice of life. They were actual true stories.
Right.
An Alison Bechdel book and Ellen Forney's book. And neither of them are in Comixology. And these are people who have won every possible comics award out there. They are New York Times bestsellers and they're not on Comixology. And I am so bothered by that because people are like, Comixology is not, you know, comics are not accessible to women. Or comics are just about spandex and capes. And here, you know, Quandary and Torchbearer are books that are not spandex and capes, but there's still, like, so far to go.
Yes.
In getting all of the diversity of comics to readers.
Yes. Can I expand on that?
Absolutely.
I feel, personally, that comic books are undergoing a bit of an indie revolution. If what confirms this is to me is the fact that Kickstarter has its own comic section for just funding comic books.
Right.
And I think it's the people, the audience, they're just, I wouldn't say tired of superheroes, because, I mean, look at the Avengers, it sells.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it sells when it's done well. Otherwise, look at Green Lantern.
Right.
Sorry.
Hi.
Sorry, DC.
Again, the book's been doing great.
Right.
The movie wasn't.
Yeah, because they really didn't know what they were doing, but I digress. But they want more. And I think the audience now is sophisticated that they see comic books as what they are, just another medium to tell a story. Not a medium for children to get superheroes, but it's the medium in and of itself. And producing a comic book costs money. I mean, let's not kid ourselves.
Oh, yeah, most people are not making any money.
At all.
People are working sometimes second jobs specifically to fund their creative endeavors.
I'm doing that right now.
Yeah.
I'm about to start a job next week that I took specifically to be able to, among other reasons, to be able to pay for more issues of Torchbearer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great and encouraging, but the market right now, like people are clamoring for this new take on comic books and new content, and I myself, I am so pro female protagonist and making sure that at least the women in my story are women and not just bimbos. And it's why I have Celine the way she is. That, because I think that's the future. I honestly think, like, it just even thinking as a businessman, women are an untapped market. And they deserve to be catered to as much as men have been in the past, God, X number of years.
Right. And the fact that, I mean, women have been in comics since the very early.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't allowed to be credited, they were there.
Right, they were, especially in Marvel. I saw a documentary about Stan Lee, and some of the first writers there, when he was in charge, were women.
Yeah.
But it's like we're in the transition phase between the old system and the old guard and the new one, but the new one really doesn't know, or at least I haven't really seen, how they can take advantage of the medium that is the internet and technology.
Yeah, and when we talk about the female audience, if we're separating it that way, which is, it's a discussion that's happening. I'm going to be on this Women in Comics panel with
right.
a couple of our friends. Amy Chu will be there. So when we talk about women in comics and female protagonists, it's I always say, I'm like, if you guys don't think it exists, you're shopping in the wrong place or you're looking at the wrong books.
Right.
Because, like I just said, I read Alison Bechdel's Are You My Mother? And then I followed that up with Marbles, A Story About Manic Depression and Bipolar Disorder from Ellen Forney. These are top cartoonists.
Yep.
They identify themselves as cartoonists because they do comic strips.
Right.
Where they got their, you know, their fan bases.
Right.
And, you know, those days are dwindling. The comic strip is, newspapers are gone. So,
right, but webcomics still exist, and that's...
Right. So webcomics are out there, and I think it was King Syndication or whatever is still in charge of making sure comic strips get into the websites of the newspaper sites. So it's like there's plenty of women out there, and especially, I mean, I don't read manga, but I have friends who go to those shows, and they're like, it is so outnumbered with females to males at those shows.
Yeah.
That, you know, if maybe what you're looking for, you're just not in the right place. And that's okay. I mean, I've had friends who like Game of Thrones, and I looked at it, and I lasted 20 minutes, and I'm like, I really don't like this.
I'm sorry.
You're not going to like everything that everybody else likes.
That's true. Hell, a lot of people won't like my stuff. I'm not going to be offended by it.
So it's just one of those things where I'm like, you know, I'm like, well, but I'm a female, you know, geek, I guess. I'm a geek girl, and I write, you know, I write stuff, and I read stuff, and, you know, I watch plenty of TV. Why don't I like the same things that my girlfriends like? They like Doctor Who. I can't stand it. I think it's awful. I think it is one of the worst productions out there.
I'm sure you're breaking my heart.
I know. I hear things breaking and shattering over there.
Yeah. That's my heart falling into pieces.
Jesus.
I thought you were my friend.
I don't, and because I'm just like, wow, I love the original Star Trek for what it was and when it was, and now when I, you know, the times I've tried to watch Doctor Who, I'm like, these people are still making this show like it's 1963, and you know, so I feel like there's something, you know, like, oh my God, there must be something wrong with me. And it's just, you know, then there's just sort of this realization of, I'm just not their audience.
That's entirely what it is.
You know, I like Leverage. I like, you know...
It's good.
I'm very upset that Leverage is gone now. But, you know, it's just, it's one of those things where... Castle.
Right.
You know,
it's
I love it.
Well, it's like Arrested Development. It's ahead of its time, people don't like it, and then Netflix comes and resurrects it, and then they get 13 episodes and then a movie.
Yeah, fantastic, and I loved it. I think it's hilarious.
It's amazing. I was just surprised that I didn't pick it up when it was out.
Oh, I didn't either. I watched it on Hulu, I think.
Yeah.
In a weekend, I cruised through that.
The point for us as creators would be to, once we know and we find who our audience is, to stick to them like butter. And just, and they grow with us and they appreciate us and help us through the good times and the bad. That's the way to survive in this day and age. And thankfully we have tools out there that can make our message, in this case our creations, go to them. And that's something we really, really, really need to understand. It's, we can't rely on a Diamond or on a Comixology or on a DC or on a Marvel to give us our content and hope that they understand us and what we want. It's not going to happen. It really is both up to the reader and up to the creator to make sure that both of each other meets and grow. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Sticking to it. What is the best piece of advice that you've received so far?
In life, as a writer.
Writer, yeah. Let's stick with we'll stick with creative endeavors.
Write what you know. It's the best piece of advice that I've read and been told. Really, write what you know. If what you know is betrayal, you know, write a good caper. if what you know is love, write a good love story, or write a horrible love story. Write from what you know. And based from that, something that interests you.
But you mentioned something like write a good love story, if you know that. Do you think that there's a place for love stories in comics?
Of course. I think comics are like animation. They're just a medium. And it depends on the creator.
Yeah, to do well is why I'm asking.
Exactly. To do the best for the medium. You could tell a good love story. In fact, I will do that. I will write a good love story for a comic book or a graphic novel.
Writer's prompt. You have your writer's prompt. Write a good love story.
It may not be my second series, but I will write a good comic book love story. Mark my words.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to hold you to that. Are you still in workshop?
Yes. Okay. I tend to lurk around the digital musings and a bunch of other digital stuff, to be honest.
Okay. And do you think you would have gotten to this point with having your comics published if you didn't have some sort of peer and mentor environment?
Good question. Probably. But it wouldn't have been as quickly as when I decided to get into comic books. Because I decided to get into comic books in 2011, New York Comic Con, from a panel that was hosted by our own Andy Schmidt.
Right.
And it was a writing panel. Yes. And Jane Espenson was there, as well as Jimmy Palmiotti, and I always forget who the third guy was. And from there, I decided, you know, this is doable. I can't believe I didn't think about doing this before. And I enrolled in Comics Experience. I think that gave me the confidence to realize that it's possible. And I would say 75% of all of this is having the confidence in yourself to believe that you can succeed.
Right. I would agree with that. And if it's that you don't know how to write a comic, like you literally don't know the technical aspects,
right,
of how a script works, there's so much information available. Dirk Manning had been doing a free column. It was up there on Newsarama. I'm sure it's still there if you want to fish through their website. called Right or Wrong, and now he's published all of his old columns. He's revamped them, make sure that it's all fresh and everything, and it's all published as a book. And there's comics experience workshops, and there's comic book school, I think is what they're calling it, out in, like, Denver.
Right.
I think New York is always having stuff. There's, I know some of the creators actually travel into Manhattan to teach workshops or classes. So it's there. You just, yes, you just need to know that there's a script. In fact, Jenny Wood, who is the creator of Flutter, she was on a couple episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Her Tumblr, she's had examples of how she scripts. How she scripts her comic Flutter, and it's very informative, very detailed, not dry, so it's not like it's a boring read by, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. You can see, like, this is a page of a script, and this is what the page translates to when drawn and thumbnailed or whatever. I think, who else? I think Kevin Maguire has even done that. And it's pretty interesting that some comics are even taking a almost like a DVD approach. They're putting out commentary.
Right.
And I think that's a lot of fun because I like that stuff. I like to know what's going through somebody's head when they're plotting and working out stories. I don't even have any confidence as a reader. So I'm always thinking I'm not thinking of something correctly. Like when I was pussyfooting around, is this a hologram or not?
Right.
I'm just never sure about what I'm reading. So when there's something like a commentary track, whether it's a blog or YouTube or something for a comic book, I think it's really cool that, like you said, it's a medium. So let's move into transmedia. Let's interact all of this.
Completely agree with that. And in fact, so one of the things that I probably will announce next week is that I'm not going to be publishing Torchbearer in print every 2 months, but rather I'm gonna compile everything as a trade.
Mm-hmm.
So like issues 1 and 3 will be compiled together, and whenever we go to conventions and things, we just sell that. It from a business standpoint, it makes more sense economically.
Yeah, it absolutely makes more sense.
But we're releasing each one as a, you know, digitally, so
yeah,
that people can stay with the story, and every 2 months they'll get the latest version, hopefully.
Yeah.
So why then should people buy the trade if it's just a printed version? And in that case, commentary and insights into the creative process, it's something people want and would appreciate in a trade, I think.
Yeah, I like that too. I like seeing concept art and commentary. And even if it's in both, like even if you say, you know, once the story arc, if you're doing 6 issues. I mean, we feel like we're so bound by this traditional 6-issue arc, and you're really not, because you're going digital. You can make your arc as long as you want.
6 issues? Really? Is that what's typical?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Minus 12.
Yeah, that would be 2 volumes. If that was like an IDW book, that would be 2 volumes.
Wow.
And, you know, with going digital, we don't have those constraints.
Yeah.
So
we don't even have the constraints of reading left to right.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I yell at people. I just yelled up at our friend Paul Aller because he had double page spreads and something.
Oh, God. In digital?
Yeah. I yelled at him.
As you should, because that doesn't work in digital.
I'm like, you can't do this.
One of the things, though, that I asked people at Comics Experience is whether they would prefer reading top to bottom, just scrolling up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And Marta suggested that, you know, it could work, and she's written a comic book like that in Italy. So it's there. I mean,
well, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people talk about the European format, and I've never seen one. So I think I have my very first one, though. I have Black Sad.
Yeah.
And I was told that that's a European style. So it's a much bigger book. It's not going to fit in a white box.
Right.
It's going to look really great on my shelf, though.
Amber, we should move to France. Honestly, I'm telling you straight up, we should totally move to France. They treat writers well, and comic books are a serious medium. So we might be royalty there.
Yeah. Is Angoulême in France, or is that Italy?
Say that again?
Angoulême?
Oh, I don't know, to be honest.
Sure. Because I know Italy has big conventions, and I think Angoulême is in France.
Probably.
And
I was in Lyon in September. Surprisingly, writing Torchbearer 2, but that's a different story. And I went shopping, and I bumped into a comic book store, and it was beautiful. And then I bumped into another comic book store, and it was beautiful. And I asked the owner, you know, in my broken down French, that he then answered in English, you know, how are comic books here? Because in the U.S., we don't see that many comic book stores anymore. And he said, in here, it's just a store that sells comics. And in Lyon, there's about 100. Come say what now?
Yeah, it does sound absolutely amazing. And in fact, while we're talking about scripting, there's a way that people can spend time in Italy working on scripts with two amazing writers.
Come say what now?
It's called the Michelangelo Screenwriting Program. It's like $3,000.
Dear audience, I am sorry. Those slots are filled right now with Amber and myself. We will be going to Italy in a bit. You can apply next year.
And they're typically screenwriters, but these guys do have a love of comics, so they said that they welcome any kind of script writing, playwriting, comic writing. They're just there to... They're traveling from L.A. to Italy to do nothing but write. And it sounds like the most incredible time that I can even... I can't even imagine it, because I've never been there. I've had family there, and I've never been there. And it's Ben Blacker and Ben Acker, which is funny that they're a writing team, because their names are almost identical.
Yeah.
Ben Blacker hosts the Nerdist Writers Panel.
Right.
And it's like one of the greatest things out there, just as a form of entertainment. And you don't even have to be a writer. If you like TV shows, and even they do occasionally have shows about comics, but if you like certain TV shows and you just want to hear how they make those TV shows, like what goes on in the writer's room without having any interest at all in script writing, you will get so much information out of like where their jokes come from, or, you know, what it means to be a showrunner versus a writing assistant, and just amazing stories of how people work their way into an industry. Like, you know, like one guy who's like this insanely famous showrunner, like started by driving the tram from a parking lot, like taking people who park their cars like into a building. Like that was his job, and now he's like a showrunner.
So
it's just these amazing stories about how people break into writing. And yeah, if I could get to Italy with them, I would be there. I would already have my tickets.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hear that as Amber is going to Italy.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. It does. And it seems like something, you know what, it sounds like these are the type of guys that will do this all, you know. They will, even if it's not Italy, I bet that they will do something every year, because they love what they do. And I think that's really cool. I mean, the fact that they do a podcast about, you know, Ben does a podcast about running.
Right.
Like, he does it, he writes Thrilling Adventure Hour because he likes to. I mean, it's not like these people are rolling in it. They're not. You don't make money off of a podcast.
But you do make money out of a screenwriter.
Screenwriter, you absolutely do. When you get to say that you wrote an episode of Supernatural,
yeah.
You know, enjoy those checks that come in. I don't have that. I never got to write for Supernatural, so.
Yeah. Soon. Don't worry. Soon.
Castle's not over.
Yeah. Supernatural isn't either.
So, yeah, Supernatural's not over. It could happen.
Actually, you know how... both Jane Espenson and Gene Roddenberry got their start?
No, and yet I think Jane Espenson has been on Nerdist Writers Panel.
She She actually was a computer scientist, studying in college, and she saw a Star Trek episode, and this was back in the day when Star Trek could actually accept open scripts.
Yeah.
Submitted one, and they brought her in.
Yeah, things are a bit different.
Yeah, unfortunately.
They allow you to pitch what they call a freelance pitch, where you're not a staff writer, and they will look at, you know, your spec just to see if you have any chops, and they will probably hate your spec. But, Star Trek is actually one of the most amazing franchises for writers.
Yes.
And directors.
Yes.
Because, you know, some people who were, you know, appeared in one episode had the opportunity to direct an episode. It's just been, they've been very open, and they've obviously been very good to their fans. They, you know, they don't seem to get as batshit crazy about, you know, saying that fans have copyright infringement issues and stuff like that. They're just like, you're fans. You're gonna post our pictures. You're gonna post video snippets. You're gonna,
right.
That's, you know, to them it propels their franchise, and that's the way I like to look at things too. So I think that Star Trek is probably the best example of that.
It is, definitely is. Surprisingly, also Star Wars. They're very not. I mean, they protect their copyright stringently, but they don't attack. They don't tend to attack fans. That's why there's so many Star Wars fan movies out there.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
And parodies, which are great, like Chad.
Oh yes.
Chad Vader.
Chad.
So Nick, while we wrap up here, please tell us where people will be able to find you. What conventions are you working on your schedule so far?
Right now, C2E2, to be honest.
Okay.
That's coming up in April.
Mm-hmm.
Truth be told, we're Odd Truth and myself especially, we're kind of new at this whole promoting comic books thing. So we're slowly but surely getting ourselves into conventions. We already did New York Comic Con, and that's going to be our staple. That's where we're going to be doing our biggest shows, New York Comic Con, and our biggest reveals and things. But we're moving slowly out of that into other places. Certainly C2E2, that's the next one on my list. We've been talking about Puerto Rico Comic Con because, well, it's Puerto Rico, and...
It's beautiful. So.
It's, yeah, and I myself grew up there, and we have family there, so it makes sense. But so far, the one that I'm definitely going to be at is C2E2.
Okay.
Yeah, that's in Chicago, April 26th through 28th, if memory serves me correct.
Okay, and is Torchbearer available right now on Comixology?
Torchbearer 1 is.
Okay.
You can download it right now. I am waiting to hear when Torchbearer 2 is coming out. It's been submitted. To be honest, that's one of the things that it's not just Comixology's problem. It's in digital. There's a lot of a conversion process, and then you submit it to the third party, whether it be the Kindle or Apple or the Nook. That's really beyond your control. And before it's given the fact that you had no information, it could take as much as a week or two between submission and release. Now, thankfully, it's been a couple of hours, which blew my mind, at least with books. So Torchbearer 2 for the iBookstore, the Kindle, the Nook perhaps, and certainly through Red Stylo Media. It's going to be available this Wednesday.
Okay.
You will get all of this information from torchbearercomics.com.
Okay, great. And is there a separate Twitter for the comic, or should people just follow you on Twitter? What do you prefer?
I like Twitter. The best way would be through following me. There's a corporate account for Odd Truth. You post there, it'll get heard. But if you want true feedback, it's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
That'll be in the show notes as well. Well, great. Nick, thank you so much for all of your time.
And, thank you, Amber.
Definitely, it's been an amazing discussion on Homeland Security and hacking and Comixology.
Well, hacking, you should talk to Janine about.
I do. I do. When I have a gun question, that's where I text. Hacking and guns, go to Janine. And, you know, hopefully I will get to connect with you and Dennis sometime this year.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Great. And guys, of course, if you want to find me on Twitter, it's at Elizabeth Amber. And you can always find all of the other show notes and blog posts and reviews at amberunmasked.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers.